because they're all part of this group and they take their orders from this group.
Excuse me. Well, we get in over here. I'm going to move to 1933 here. Adolf Hitler becomes chancellor. Now, of course, he was already well-financed. His ideas, his party, his control was beginning to find its way into all of the smaller villages and hamlets and had control over the major cities as well. But now he takes the chancellor's position, and so the crime wave that is to come is pretty much already organized and written. And what do you want to say about this 1933 period?
Well, I mean, to hit the question is going to be one that I really hope I can answer at some point. It's similar to the what we talked about earlier with Churchill seemingly starting off. Was he part of this group? Was he against it? I think was part of it all along. Hitler, one thing I heard recently that I think could really be... is quite a plausible explanation for Hitler, is Hitler was internationalism, and this group could see nationalism could be a way to control the people, because you could have someone like Hitler turning up and saying, right, we need to do this for the benefit of our country, and everybody goes on and does it, and so if it's for the benefit of the bankers, great. But what this article I read indicated, the reason that Hitler had fallen out with the Zionists was that the Zionists wanted this on a global scale, but Hitler wanted it on a national scale. And so the long-term aims didn't match up. They want a world government, and Hitler wanted this form of government for every government, if you see what I mean.
Mm.
And that was where I sort of read that, and it kind of shot a bit of light on why they might have fallen out.
Well, we know that of course the building, the rebuilding of Germany came through these bankers, and of course we know that Max Warburg stayed in his home in Hamburg all the way up until 1943, I believe, before he left. So the fact is that many of the Jews that were prominent in the German hierarchy were left in power. I put an article up on my site recently that says there were actually many Jews working within the Hitler government, and that's been proven. And now what we know is that he had less problem with some Jews and more with others. Now, my take on that has always been that he helped get rid of the opposition to Zionism, because what I knew was that in the northern European area, Poland and Germany, there were cosmopolitan Jews that did not believe in this Zionist model of building Palestine into a new Jewish homeland, and they preferred staying put where they were. And in fact, they did not adhere to this. You'll hear this story told by Nutura Carta. Now, whether or not it's entirely true or only partially true, it does seem to fit somehow that the best way for these Zionists to get rid of their opposition would be for to have Hitler do their dirty work for them and have them become slave laborers in Hitler's war machine, and then ultimately subjugated and starved to the point of eradication, so that the people standing up against Zionism would be eliminated.
Well, I again, that's a theory that does hold water down, and this is the thing with Hitler. There's so much of it doesn't make sense. You know, if he's against all Jews, then why has he got so many working with him? What you've said there makes sense. And the other thing I would say is, back in 1897, when we had our first World Jewish Congress, or the Zionist out of Basel, Switzerland, which is the Protocols of Zion, are believed to be a kind of transcript or blueprint from that meeting. That meeting was due to be held in Munich, in Germany, but what happened was local opposition from Jews forced them to move it to Basel, Switzerland, because the Jews in Munich said, hey, we don't want any of this supremacist nonsense, we're happy where we are, we're happy integrating with the community. And so as a result, they had to move it from Munich to Switzerland. And so what you've just said, that would reinforce your thoughts there, that maybe this whole World War II scenario was various different aims, but one of them was to move the willing Jews to Palestine, which would become Israel, for the simple reason, you you know, the Rothschilds can buy a country, but you can't have a country without a population, so they got the population that way. And at the same time, eliminate those who choose not to go along with it and put them, and take them out, so to speak. And that certainly seems to be a very plausible explanation of what happened.
Well, and you see, you can get that further codified in your mind by looking at the transfer agreement, by looking at the joint ventures that the Nazis undertook, moving people to Palestine. They had very prominent Nazis visiting the Palestine region in the 30s. There were joint statements made by Zionist members, as well as the Nazis standing on podiums together, declaring certain things jointly. So it does look like that might have been the case, and there it would start really clarifying some of the reasons why so many Jews were put into servitude, and it would explain a lot more than of the questions that we've all had. Now, we move on here to this Holocaust Memorial, September 1939, and so forth. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, I just want to sort of state what it says. We're not offering any views here. The museum, it states, on September 1939, approximately 282,000 Jews had left Germany, and 117,000 from annexed Austria. Of these, some 95,000 emigrated to the United States, 60,000 to Palestine, 40,000 to Great Britain, and about 75,000 to Central and South America, with the largest numbers entering Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Bolivia. The listeners will probably be aware that Hugo Chavez over in Venezuela has had some run-ins with groups over there that have come from this community.
Yeah.
More than 18,000 Jews from the German Reich were also able to find refuge in Shanghai in Japanese-occupied China. At the end of 1939, about 202,000 Jews remained in Germany and 57,000 in annexed Austria. And so essentially we're only talking about 259,000 Jews being named by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in 1939. It's important to go into the definition then of what Holocaust survivor means, because this is a definition that's set up again by this museum. And it's such as any Jew who lived in a country at the time when it was 1. Under Nazi regime, 2. Under Nazi occupation, or 3. Under regime of Nazi collaborators, as well as any Jew who fled due to the above regime or occupation. And so all the people that left, and we can go back to the transfer agreement, which is when the Nazis and the Jews in Palestine collaborated for the Jews to be expelled from Germany and go into Palestine. These, at that time, as a result of that agreement, 60,000, which was approximately 20% of Germany's Jews, emigrated to Palestine and made up 15% of the Jewish population there by 1939. The interesting thing is they take with them $40 million of assets, which is worth approximately $600 million at the time of the writing of the book, 2006, with the blessing of the Nazi regime. But you see, these people who've left Germany and gone to Palestine. Now, it might not have been exactly what they wanted, but they were not stripped of all their assets. They weren't allowed to leave with all their property, and they took this amount of money with them. These people could essentially still be referred to as Holocaust survivors, because they would fall under the third part of the definition, which is under regime of Nazi collaborators. They'd fall into all three categories. They lived in a country that was under Nazi regime, under Nazi occupation, or under regime of Nazi collaborators, as well as any Jew who fled due to the above regime or occupation. And so it's important to quantify this, because I think that when people think Holocaust survivor, they think that someone was found in a concentration camp, starved to death, and literally managed to nurse themselves back to health, when this definition is clearly not the case. And I think it's important that people are aware, so we have a full understanding of history.
Well, and then we get on to Franklin Delano Roosevelt being Jewish, and that's pretty clear that he was a Sephardic Jew. And again, the participation of wealthy Sephardi of course, many of the Sephardic Jews that were forced out of Spain and Portugal after the Inquisition moved to Holland, to the Dutch protectorate of Amsterdam, which they still control today, and then ultimately over to the New World in New York, especially because that was called New Holland at the time. And what we see is the Roosevelt family and fortune and power structure having Jewish roots. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, well, his real name was Rosenfeld. So again, we've got a crypto-Jew here. He was very interesting because, of course, he was behind this New Deal nonsense when we have the confiscation of gold, essentially. It was under his presidency we had the all-seeing eye on the dollar bill and the Novus Ordo Seclorum motto above it, which is the Latin for New Order of the Ages, so it's not exactly New World Order, but it's it fits. He also recognised the Bolshevik regime of Stalin in Russia, and he did that without consultation of Congress on November the 16th of this year.
Yep.
33. And at the same time, 8,000 Ukrainians marched in protest in this in New York. Now, Roosevelt never admitted his Jewish ancestry, but in the New York Times of March 14th, 1935, he is quoted as saying the following: "In the distant past, my ancestors may have been Jews. All I know about the origin of the Roosevelt family is that they are apparently descendants of Claes Martensen van Roosevelt, who came from Holland." Now, of course, you just said about the Spanish side going to Holland. The other interesting thing is, of course, we had the when you look at the New York, for example, the real centre of this group, of course, that started off New Amsterdam, didn't it?
Yes, right.
And with the Bank of England, the people that came over and set that up all came from Amsterdam. That's when you have William of Orange coming over.
Yeah.
Under the condition that these people could set up a central bank. So, you know, it is a real centre there, Amsterdam is. And there's indicators that we've just described that show that.
Well, let's move on here to Jabotinsky in January, a staunch Zionist in 1934. Well, I wanted to say what he talks about with the update on Untermeyer's boycott of Germany, what he had to do and say.
Well, for listeners, Dale's got a great page about the Untermeyer speech. I just quote excerpts of it in the book. But Vladimir Jabotinsky is talking about the boycott of Germany, which took place because Hitler forced out all these Jews that were working in the German government because he said that they were communist. As a result of this, Untermeyer called for a boycott of Germany, German goods. And Jabotinsky stated, "The fight against Germany has now been waged for months by every Jewish community, on every conference, in all labor unions, and by every single Jew in the world. There are reasons for the assumption that our share of this fight is of general importance. We shall start a spiritual and material war of the whole world against Germany. Germany is striving to become once again a great nation, and to recover her lost territories as well as her colonies. But our Jewish interests call for the complete destruction of Germany. Collectively and individually, the German nation is a threat to us Jews." And of course, one of the main threats is because what Hitler had done is he'd essentially kicked out the bankers and started printing his own money again, which made the prosperity there, and of course gives us this additional fog over, you know, who Hitler really was, who he was supported by, and what his purpose was, because it's a real it's an absolute enigma to try and work out.
It is. It's very difficult. Well, there were other people fighting against them. One of them was David Lloyd George, who clearly states in June of that same year that Britain is a slave of the international financial bloc. Does he not?
Yeah, he must have been sort of the Alex Jones of his day, because he talks about the international financial bloc without actually naming who they are.
There you go.
So he was a prime minister. So again, he said, I think that these people, they kind of almost have in jokes with each other. They say, well, I'll say a little bit, I won't go too far, but just to sort of show that I can and get published, my words published and stuff. Just, you know, might have had a bit of an argument with one of them the day before, and so he comes out and says something. It's all just a big game to these people in power, and the people that suffer as normal individuals like you and I, Daryl, and it's really is time that we use the information that we've been able to find out and, you know, use this to our advantage and take not just your country and my country back, but the whole world from this group.
Well, I am not going to, you know, diverge from that goal here. And here's the next statement is very telling from this Jewish writer who wrote a book called The Jews Must Live, Samuel Roth. I'll let you read it because it's very powerful.
Yep. Excuse me. He says, our major vice of old, as of today, is parasitism. We are a people of vultures living on the labour and the good nature of the rest of the world. But despite our faults, we would never have done so much damage to the world if it had not been for our genius for evil leadership. Granted, our parasitism. So there you have it. He's stating there exactly what we've seen happen from what we've been through to the start of this file to now.
Well, we've actually put our finger directly on the pulse of these criminals, and we know what they've done. Our goal here is to get more people to understand how deep this crime wave really goes and the historic roots that it has. The next one here, and it's our last for today, we're going to talk a little bit about the, what is it, Elizabeth Donnan publishes her four-volume set, Documents Illustrative of the History and Slave Trade in America. This is important because I've just recently put some things up on the site regarding this.
Yeah, this is very important, and there's a lot more information you can find on the site, and also if you type in her name and just type in Jewish-owned slave ships, etc., etc., and this guilt complex is not just pushed on the American people, but also on the British people. We have Tony Blair apologising on behalf of all the British people against slavery only sort of a year or so ago. I think it was just before he left as Prime Minister, was replaced by Gordon Brown. Now, certainly my ancestors never owned slaves. I'm sure many of the listeners' ancestors didn't either. But they'll have you believe it was all down to us and we owe this, that and the other. What she's actually stated, and this is a book that came out in volumes between 1930 and 35, she lists the ships, the owners of the ships, and they're all Jewish names. And she goes into details of how they were used, what they were used for. I've only got a paragraph on it here, but it's certainly well worth looking into, and it's well worth a good read. There are other books on this subject, but do not in any way believe that the slave trade was a whites-only institution. White families certainly did buy the slaves, but the people that brought them in are from this community. And finally, I just wanted to say that this is a very important quote, because on page there's a guy called Dr. Solomon Freehoff who wrote a pamphlet called Race, Nation or Religion, Three Questions Jews Must Answer. And he says in this pamphlet, and this just tells you all about the world government we're looking at today, he says, we want a world in which nationalism shall definitely diminish.
And we are going to leave it there. You know, I'm going to urge the listeners to buy this book because it's a powerful reference. We do provide each excerpt that we do on the site for people to read, and Andrew's been kind enough to do that here for us. But to have this as a way of informing other people, you don't have to bring, you know, there's a lot of people out there who don't regularly visit websites, or they don't feel like reading things off of a screen, and much prefer a book. This book is easy to read because it jumps quite seamlessly from story to story, and the timeline is just extraordinary. And Andrew, you know, your help on the French Connection cannot be overstated here. It's just an important thing that we bring up every couple of weeks here, and I'm so happy that you came on to do this again.
Well, it's great for me as well, Dale, because I wouldn't choose any other forum but your own to, you know, it's my real choice to get this message out. And I always remember that it was one of the first articles ever on the site when the site, you had the radio station for a while before you had a site, when you started off on RBN and then GCN, and I remember it was up there when there were only a few, you know, a handful of articles on the site, and it's kind of grown since then. And what we're trying to do for the listeners is bother and put a whole book up that people will have it all on the screen and think, oh, I've got 300 pages of this to read. And if we put it up in these little, a chunk at a time, which is, you know, only 12 pages word, 30 book pages at a time, which is very easy to get through quite quickly, then at least they'll be picking it up. It'll give them the opportunity to find what they're interested in. They can look at different search engines to find out more about that. And I would encourage them to donate to the French Connection for to help keep this message getting out there. If they want to purchase the book, they can go to www.thesynagogueofsatan.com. I've literally got a handful of the first editions left now. If they want the copy that Tex Mars published, which has an index and a forward by Tex, they can get that from either texmars.com or all the Amazon sites seem to carry it, amazon.com, etc. The copies coming from me, I always sign them, so if you want that, then I accept PayPal, so go to cityofthesatan.com. And I encourage you, if you can't afford it, please throw a few dollars to Daryl, and within a few months every excerpt of the book will be up there. There's only three left for Daryl and I to do, and if you can be patient and you haven't got the money to pay for it, then by all means wait for them to come up there and you can read them all up on the site for free.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I appreciate your time today, and I know it was last minute to request this from you, but it's worked out quite well, and I want to thank you again, my friend.
Thank you very much, Daryl.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for tuning in today's broadcast. It was a very important broadcast because it ties together so much information of the last century to today. Things, as much as they change, they remain the same. We've had our finger on the pulse of this criminal gang from the start, and we're doing our best to show you the facts around the conspiracy. So until the next time, please take care of your families. Lots of difficult moments are on our horizon. And be well, all of you. Bye-bye now.
Baby. I can wake up with the tears.